Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the Fireside Room, Ralph Gerke is speaking on Archaeology and the Bible, New Testament Archaeology. So let's listen in on Ralph Gerke.
Just to review, is in the first session, I took the main ideas of archaeology, how to take a buried city and dig through it without destroying the evidence. Now that's a real trick, because once you dig into it, you destroy the evidence. And that's the way people used to do archaeology, to find treasures. But they realized that this didn't actually give the evidence that you can get from a buried city, because a buried city is buried in strata. And if you can peel it off, you can identify the strata and you control your evidence, the fine spot of everything that you find. And therefore your evidence for what you're finding is very good. So that's the first thing I did. The second thing, please come in, had to do with the second word in the title of the course, and that is the word bio. Question?
You're going to use your FM thing?
Yep, I've got it on. And if you will take this.
Okay.
And
They don't have a loop, huh? Now some places they have an FM loop around. All you have to do is to turn your hearing aid on telephone and it picks it up.
Listen, if you go to that girl in that room over there, and she'll tell you the answer. I don't know that answer.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Why don't you do that, and then you can come back in.
Very good.
I don't know just how.
I'll leave that here.
All right. Good. So, and the second thing we did is to kind of look at the Bible in a little different way than we usually do. The Bible is meant for Christian community and for the synagogue, as far as the Old Testament is concerned, or a church. But when we find these things and we look at them academically, we find old manuscripts. And so what we're going to do, and you'll see quite a bit of that from the Dead Sea Scrolls today, how this sheds light on our looking at the Bible. So I wonder whether we can begin. What I'm going to do is turn off these lights here. And then what I'd like to have you do is ask any questions while we're hearing this. I guess I forgot to put this here. Okay. And I'll be sure and try to answer them. Kind of a little bit of a review here, and that is when the children of Israel were taken to Babylon, this is perhaps the way in which the city looked. We can reconstruct this. The German excavators worked here for many years, and they dug up the large Tower of Babylon. Some people call it the Tower of Babel. You have the Tigris River here. You have a double wall. Those walls are 80 feet, thank you. Those walls are 80 feet high, big enough for two chariots to pass each other. This is the large temple of the god Marduk, and it was a tremendous large city. Now the Jews were not, the exiles weren't put into, say, a prison or something like that in this city, but they were assigned certain villages next to the Kibar Canal, and that's where they lived. Among them was this prophet, whom we call the prophet to the exiles, Isaiah to the exiles. And though I had some naughty boys, I used to teach in the Lutheran prep school, and they put a mustache on the original copy. And nothing worse than young boys who are going to become priests or Lutheran ministers. And these boys did that in the prep school for me. Kind of spoiled the picture, but I think you can, if you can ignore that, this is a picture of one of the prophets. We call him the prophet to the exiles, or sometimes second Isaiah, who says, "They that trust in the Lord will mount up like eagles. They will not faint, but they will be strong. And he gave them many, many prophecies, including the famous one that we read in Good Friday in the churches about the servant of the Lord that will succeed where all other servants failed. He was tremendous for helping them get ready. He also said that the one who was going to help them was a conqueror by the name of Cyrus, a Persian. And in fact, he even calls him in chapter 45 of the book of Isaiah, my Messiah, mine anointed one. And that's what really happened. The Persians took over, and this is from the title of a book. You can see it was a German book printed in East Germany before unification, but a really fine book that shows what is found at one of the four royal cities of the Persians. The roofs of these places were burned off. Alexander did that. And the mud brick of the walls fell down. But you can see where the gateways and all these things are still there. And many of these large things are there. It's a tremendous place. It's one of these many places that I've never had a chance to visit. But this marvelous book from East Germany has some marvelous pictures to give you an idea of what an empire the Persians, beginning with Cyrus, the same one mentioned in the Bible, established. On their New Year's Day, when all the nations would bring tribute to Cyrus, they would march coming to a state way. This would be some of the palaces in each one of the new kings of the Persians would build a new palace. And thus it became a very great royal city. My university, the University of Chicago, did much of the excavations there in the early days. Here they're coming in to the gateway, and this is the famous gateway of the nations. And it has all kinds of sculptures of these people. They entered this large, very, very large place. And here you can see the gates, tremendously big gates, and one of the palaces on one of those festival days. Now they're going up inside to the audience hall where Cyrus and the rest of the Persian kings would be. So we can imagine that when these Jews were now allowed, the Persians were very tolerant, quite different than the Babylonians. They were allowed to go back home. And the Cyrus made the edict that they could go back home. Here are some more pictures of a courtyard, or this is the largest one. Imagine if you had an audience with a Persian king. This is where he was.
What was the name of this place?
Adapa. Persepolis is the name of the town. Persepolis is the name of the town, and this building is called the Adapa. And it has very, very large columns. You see how large they are. Tremendous. And sometimes the people who worked at the court, remember Daniel worked at the court of Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonians, and he was a Jew. And some of them that worked here in the court of the Persians were also Jews. And they have the famous story about Esther, who was a very beautiful woman, who became a concubine and wife even of Artaxerxes, Ahasuerus, one of the Persian kings. And so in that case, the Jews who were supposed to be persecuted were rescued from the persecution. The Jews still celebrate the rescue through Esther on their day of Purim. And boys and girls, I happen to be in Israel this year when they had Purim. They dress up and all kinds of things, and they speak about Haman, the terrible persecutor that was against them. So this is very lively Jewish history. And some of the Israelites now who were in captives, we can call them Jews, they were able to get back to the Holy Land. But it was a very difficult sort of thing. And from the National Geographic's book, you have this illustration. I think it's quite good. of some of the Jews coming back here in their early times to Jerusalem. You remember the walls had been destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar, and it was a hard time to bring it up. Unfortunately, however, there were several prophets. One of them was Zechariah, who another one was Haggai, had brought many promises of the future of God's establishment, and with Persian help, Persians even paid the money in order to stabilize their empire. You see, there are two ways of running an empire. You can either be brutal and make everybody toe the line, or what you can do the opposite is what? Be nice and that they follow obediently. And in this case, the Persians were tolerant. So that the Jews were able to go back, and it was very, very difficult. When they built the second temple, we're told the famous story in the book of Ezra that the old people who had seen the first temple of Solomon wept because the new temple was so dinky, it could easily have fit within this room. And as the young people who didn't know any different, they just praised God and thanked Him. Yes.
I had a question on geography. Where they were held captive, that was now Iraq?
Yes, in Babylon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's and right. Persepolis, isn't that in Turkey? Or
it's
that?
It's modern Iran.
Modern Iran, okay.
Modern Iran, okay. Correct, yeah. Mm-hmm. Persia.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, the big change came when Alexander the Great conquered the Persians. You perhaps know that story. On the basis of a mosaic we have here, found in Pompeii, Alexander, who often engaged in the actual fighting himself. Remember his young man? Conquered the world, I think, was he 32, something like that?
32 when he died.
He and Mozart, something like that, yeah. It wasn't as glorious as most of the books say. He drank himself to death. He really pushed himself too far. And here's the Persian king Darius fleeing from Mosaic, but the idea is correct that he actually conquered the whole area. It was a tremendous area. He actually wanted to go he crossed the Indus River into India and wanted to get into China, but the soldiers rebelled, and he came back. He also had promises, plans, I should say, when he came back, he never fulfilled them, to go way out to the west to go to Spain. He would have been a really tremendous conqueror. And what he did is brought Greek culture to this area, so that most of the culture from now on we call Hellenistic or Greek culture. And now the big question that we should ask as students of the Bible is, what did that mean for the Jews? Well, to make a long story short, at first the Jews thought they'd get a better advantage. But as it turned out, it wasn't so great. And so when the high priests compromised with the Greek rulers, many of the old-fashioned Jews said no. And many of them then moved out of Jerusalem, out to, this is the famous place near the Dead Sea of Qumran, where out in the desert, this is a dry river based, in caves, this happens to be cave number 4, there are about 11 caves, they found these manuscripts. And then the scholars began to excavate ruins. They knew there were ruins there, but there are ruins, a lot of ruins that have never been excavated or studied carefully archaeologically in Palestine. They had found some Roman coins there, and they said, well, that's one of those Roman fortresses from the time when the Romans were there. But when they excavated it very carefully, they found this settlement. Some people call them Jewish monks, but it isn't right to call this place a monastery, because a monastery is where people have a dormitory where they sleep and where they eat and so forth, whereas this place is more a place of worship. They lived outside in temporary structures, sometimes in tents. Some of them were married. But as far, it was a man's world entirely in the old days. And coming inside here, they came in for worship services. And they said that what was going on in Jerusalem was so Hellenistic, compromised with Jewish thought and Jewish culture, that they would have nothing to do with it. And because they lived here in this isolated place and tried to keep up all the laws that were given in the Torah, in the Old Testament, and they had their manuscripts, that's why they had these beautiful manuscripts of the Bible. Question.
What year did this occur?
Oh yes, I think the big problem started in about 153 BC. So that was the first group that went on. See, they've dug here and they find various phases here. I won't go into that detail, but they found various phases. This is the largest phase. And at first they were very much at loggerheads with the priests up in Jerusalem. In the latter part, they made their peace with those priests, and there was a better communication, see. But they still have their own writings, and we can read them. And, well, this gives you perhaps better than my talking. A picture is better than 1,000 words, isn't it? This is, again, from a National Geographic reconstruction, but a very good reconstruction, of this group in actual ceremonial worship. One man is explaining the Torah, and they would have groups of 12 men, one for each of the tribes, you see. They would have a Messiah of Aaron, of the priest, and a Messiah of David, of the king. One of those men would represent that. And so their liturgy would prepare for the coming of the new age when the Messiah would come. So these people are very much waiting for the coming of the kingdom of God. They also had meals in which they ceremonially ate of the sacrificial meat. You know, there are two types of sacrifices. One, you burn it all up, 100% to the Lord, and the other one is what? You give only certain parts that are burnt to the Lord, and other parts are shared with the priests and the people. Kind of a barbecue, you see that? And that's what they did. They had many ceremonies, and we have their writings. We have, just like, let's say, a Benedictine monastery, St. Martin's at Lacey here in Washington, will have its rule of St. Benedict, and we'll follow that. These people had their rules, and we have it. We can translate it, you see that? So it gives us a tremendous background for the time of Jesus and of the New Testament. So Qumran is extremely important. It's perhaps the most important discovery of the 20th century. Found by Arab boy in a shepherd boy who he and his cousin were out with their sheep not far away at from this site, and he threw up a stone into a hole and it clinked, and he thought it was a genie up there. Well, his cousin wasn't as afraid as he, and as scared, and he walked up there and he found the scrolls. And when they found the scrolls, they took them back. They happened to be Christians, Syrian Orthodox Christians, took them back to their bishop in Bethlehem. And their bishop was learned, and he realized that it was important. So he went to the American School of Oriental Research in Jerusalem, and a man who was an expert in manuscripts happened to be on duty. His name is Trevor. He was in Claremont, California. And the man almost had a heart attack because these manuscripts were 100 years older than the manuscripts that we had before. Can you imagine that? And so, therefore, all night he said, could he keep it? He was an excellent photographer, too, and he made excellent photographs because the man wanted back. Later on, it was sold, and it's now in the Israel Museum in Jerusalem. But this was quite important. Now, what you see here is part of what we call their manual discipline. One man up there is reading the liturgy. And they are initiating this man into their order. Some people call them the Essenes, that could be. Now he's going to be a member. They had him on trial for 2 years as a kind of a postulant, and then if he would keep all these laws and so forth, he could become a member of the community. Now, there were many of these basins for washing there. In fact, the German scholar von Harnack said, those little people spent a lot of time in the bathtub. Well, it isn't that. It was that if you committed any sin, say you became angry with your fellow or you broke even part of the law, you had to wash yourself in what they call a mikvah, the hell of August. This particular picture shows, however, their initiation. Well, we Christians have our baptism where we're initiated into what? The death and resurrection of Christ, isn't it? And put down, and in the old days they did it three times and dunked you, really. Sometimes I think it's valid in Northern Hemisphere to have washing with the water, but this is the old way. Question?
Well, Ralph, you said that the Dead Sea Scrolls were 100 years older.
1,000 years.
Yeah, it should be 1,000 years older than the oldest previously known.
Yeah, it's 1,000 years.
Isaiah.
Yeah, that's correct. I'm sorry, if I said 100, I meant 1,000. Yeah. Yes, they
and
are.
That Isaiah is almost identical.
Pardon?
And the Isaiah they found at the time, the Dead Sea Scrolls, is almost identical to the ones we have.
Yes,
which is
I'll show
an amazing tribute to the accuracy.
Yes,
with
correct.
Which the translation correct. Was carried
yeah.
out.
Yeah, except that you really would have to add, Pastor Schrader, that there were two of them. The one is identical. The other one has many more variants. You see that?
I didn't realize.
Yes. So when archaeologists find things, they find things sometimes that fit with our tradition, and sometimes they find things that don't fit. See?
Exactly.
Then you have to explain also that. See? But basically, we have a good tradition. Now, this may be, again, it's a reconstruction, the way in which those manuscripts were made. It's almost mass production, isn't it? One man reads it, and they copy it. Is there a chance for him misreading?
Yes.
For them to miscopy?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's human. This is the human side of Scripture. There's nothing magic about it. It's holy. That man must wash his hands first before he touches them, and he must wash his hands after, because it's so holy. So these are our manuscripts. And I'll give you an example now. First of all, this is the way they buried them, especially these very precious manuscripts. They made these jars specially for them, and they thought that the Romans were coming in that war in 63 and to 70, and they'd bury this and they'd come back and pick it up. But they were killed and they never came back and picked it up until those boys found it in 1948, which is rather surprising. Now, here is a good example of just what you've asked, Pastor. This is the famous Isaiah scroll. And this is the one of two scrolls that were found there that is very, very close to the rabbinical one, or the ones that we would find in our English translations. You notice how it's made, put together here, the skin of clean animals, parchment. And it's been used a long time, hasn't it? You can see that it had been used a long time before it was put in that jar. You can see there. And here, I just give you the translation here. Kol kol rei b'midbar, a voice is crying in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord. So we know that comes from what? Isaiah 40, verse 1, the one that we hear at Adventine, isn't it? That's always there. And another thing that you can see in this particular one, it starts here with verse 6. I'll give you that up above there, and you can kind of see. I'll teach you a little Hebrew. A voice says, cry. But I, the prophet, says, what should I cry? All flesh is like the flower of the field. It's beautiful, and then what happens to it?
It
withers. The grass withers, the flower fades, isn't it? But the word of our God doesn't fade. It will rise to each education, to each occasion. Now, notice what has happened here. I did this in Chicago, and one of my former students in the congregation where I did this said, I'll help you, Professor, for teaching this, and he did. And so I came to him, and we collaborated, and we put an English translation over the top of this. So what you have here in English is what up there is in the main manuscript underlined in red. So a voice says, cry, be my prophet. But I say, what's the use of being a prophet? Everything falls apart. We're in exile, we'll never get home. You see that? And that's the idea. And then here comes something else. And notice, it's written up above, isn't it? I put it in green here, isn't it? And not only that, the guy is a different writer. He doesn't write as well. And he puts it, look at these scribbles all the way down to the end here. It's kind of a gloss. You see, that's in the manuscript. And you can see this, and he put a little screen here. That's kind of nice. When the breath of Yahweh, and by the way, they didn't want to at this period, this second person won't use that name of God. God's real name, like my name is Ralph. God's real name is Yahweh. I am that I am. And they won't write that anymore. They'll just put four dots to it, you see that? And that's why this a student of mine put this in italics. When the breath of Yahweh blows upon it, surely the people is grass. You see, he's trying to explain this. The grass withers and the flower fades. And then he writes all the way down the line, but the word of our God will remain forever. So there gives you an example of a manuscript. Is it precisely the way our manuscript is? Kind of. But it also shows us that they added things, didn't they? There's a growing book, and we have to be honest. And it wasn't just reproduced the way we have with accuracy, say, a digital high tech. There's just no doubt about that. But let's take the text the way it's now printed in modern Bibles. A voice says, cry, but I say, what should I cry? All flesh is grass, all its beauty is like the flower of the field. The grass withers, the flower fades. But now we have to skip down here. But the word of our God. In Hebrew, that word but is but the word Devar Eloheinu Yakum Adolam. And you know when Jesus said to the little daughter Jairus, we even have that in the New Testament, he said to her, Talitha kum, damsel, arise, isn't it? The word of our God will rise to each occasion. So you be my prophet, Isaiah, and I will see to it that the word that I give you will rise to each occasion and be fulfilled. Do you see that? It's a beautiful explanation, and it keeps the text nice and clear. And if you ask, well, how shall I, as a layperson that doesn't know Hebrew, understand this? Any good translation today, up to date, will, in the footnotes, give you all these things. It will actually give you what we have here, too. Do you see that? So they're not trying to keep things from you.
What is the date of the...
Of this manuscript comes from about 100 B.C., so this is before the time of Jesus. So when Jesus came to the synagogue in Nazareth, we don't know what scroll he took out of their scroll cabinet, but he must have had something like this other scroll. You see that?
Right. Now, the Hebrew Empire, the temple was destroyed in what?
60 AD? The second temple was kind of expanded by King Herod. I'll show you some pictures of that. But then, underneath his sons, when everything kind of fell apart, it was destroyed in the year 70 by the Romans.
70 A.D. So
yeah, 70 A.D.
So they were burying these.
Oh yes, this was about
200 years.
Yeah, it was a manuscript that was very old. You see that? Just like today, if I go to the Tacoma synagogue, they'll have some old Jewish Torahs that come from the 18th century. You see that? Even though they live in the 20th century, they'll try to keep old manuscripts there.
But we saw it from the earlier photograph, it was quite worn and used.
That's right. But you see, we don't know precisely. Some people say this came originally from the high priest's collection of manuscripts when they first founded this community. So, but how these where these scrolls came from originally, we don't know. There's a lot of speculation, and we'll keep on working at it, you see that? But it's the best evidence, and as the pastor rightly corrected me, it's 1,000 years older than the rabbinical writings that we had before.
Well, isn't it thought that Jesus may have been a member of the Essene community at some time?
I've heard that. I don't think very much. In fact, if Jesus had come down there with Jesus' ideas about the freedom, and we had it in the gospel last Sunday, about what makes you clean and so forth, they'd thrown him out right off the bat. He would have never gotten along with those people. They were strict, very Jewish, you see that?
Yeah.
And remember, Jesus says, people aren't made for the law are made for people. And many of the sayings of Jesus.
Well, it didn't say stay very long.
No. The only person in the Bible who might have come to this place might have been John the Baptist. You know, it says that in the first chapter of Luke that after his parents died, they were old, and then he went out into the desert and lived in the desert to Israel when he started that revival meeting, see? And that's not far away from here. So some people say he might have been there. But he was preparing for the Messiah too, did you see that? But he collaborated with this young carpenter from Nazareth, you see that? Until finally he had his head cut off. Oh, wait, so I should explain that. Here's just a fragment, in Cave 4 especially. Although this comes from Cave 1, that's the symbol. They have many fragments, but this is a fragment from Cave 1, and you can see I have only part of it. But what's interesting is that this comes from Daniel chapter 1. This comes from the story of the dream of Nebuchadnezzar in Daniel chapter 2. And at this point, though the rest of this is Hebrew, it starts from here on in Aramaic, which is another cousin language of Hebrew. And everybody had been wondering about that. Who changed that? Well, we could wonder whether the rabbis did that later. Here we find that in this old manuscript from the Dead Sea, Daniel says to King Nebuchadnezzar, "O king, live forever." And he's talking Aramaic, you see that? And it says the word, is a cut off here, Aramith. In Aramaic he said, "O king, live forever." So this gives us the oldest and best manuscript that we have. Now, some of them are very controversial. There are about 400 little fragments that have been isolated from many things. They can now be seen with infrared, because then you can get what? All the carbon on it, you see that? You couldn't hardly see much of this with your naked eye, even if you were an expert. And then you can enhance it with computers. So this is just one of them. This is one of the most controversial ones. Whether it's sometimes called the pierced Messiah or the piercing Messiah. And here it says, for instance, Isaiah the prophet, and it quotes just what we hear at Christmas time from Isaiah 11 about the stem of Jesse. That means from David's line that the Messiah is born. And of course, our Christian idea is that this Jesus is the Messiah. And this word right here is the big one. You see, they did not write in Hebrew with vowels. That means that you can get twice as much on this page as you could in an English page. And therefore, you have to put the vowels in. But once in a while, it's ambiguous. You can translate Yith-mo-thu or Yith-mo-tho, because this above over here can either have the idea of U or it can have the idea of O. So it can be either they pierce him or he pierces them. So people argue about it, and the radicals, sometimes they're the only ones that the newspaper reports, say, well, the crucifixion of Jesus is really kind of a myth. It didn't really happen. It's just a story that they said that the Messiah would be pierced, but the translation can also be what? Would pierce the Gentiles, you see that? How can you argue about that and come to conclusions? Any honest scholar would simply say, it's an open question, isn't it? And you can't do that. But very often what we get in the newspapers is what I like to call tabloid scholarship. So you better go back to scholarship that you have to be a little more careful. It isn't just what you'd like to have. Does that give you an idea of where the problems are? Someone in the last session said, has there been a lot of hanky-panky going on? No. The big problem was this, that they had only 10 men working at these schools at the beginning. And that was far too few. They took two Americans, one from Harvard, Frank Cross, and Patrick Seacon from the Catholic University in Washington, D.C., American team. He did the same thing in Germany and the same thing in France. Well, one of the Frenchmen, happened to be a Roman Catholic father, became a drunkard. And he didn't publish all the stuff that was given to him. You see that? The English-British team was even worse. One of the men that was on that became followed Timothy Lear into LSD, got kicked out of Oxford and got kicked out of that. So they made mistakes, you see that? But they have reconstructed the whole thing. And then this is true too, that many of the Israeli scholars were left out in the cold because these manuscripts were held in the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan, an Arab kingdom. But the same thing is happening today when Israel has control of this whole land and many of the other scholars can't get a hold of it. But that happens to any manuscript, you see that? So any special hanky-panky, I just don't agree with that it's that much. It's, and what I really don't like is a lot of people are publishing books that are headlines and so forth and making a mint out of that. And I don't think scholars should do that. I think they should be honest.
These scrolls were discovered what year again?
1948.
48.
So yes, right. And they went at it right away. And you see, this was the day when at the time when the British gave up the mandate, and then there was a lot of fighting. But it was natural, therefore, that since this was found in the Arab sections that the Arabs would control, at least the first scholarship. But since the Six-Day War, the Israelis have taken over the Rockefeller Museum with all these treasures inside of it, and now they do it. Get the idea?
Is that the reason, more or less, that in the last 4 or 5 years there have been, as you mentioned, recent publications?
Oh, yes. There were some errors. This man, the man who became a drunkard from the French scene, just became a recluse and didn't share it with people for a longer period of time. But finally, his Roman Catholic fellow scholars shook it loose. Do you see that? So there was a delay, I have to say that. Things happen. Yes?
I was wondering about the fragments, where they were found. The scrolls were rolled up and put in these jars. Were the fragments scattered around among the dust and dirt, and they had to sift these to get the fragments?
The main wonderful scrolls were in jars. But there were so many others that are just loose, and of course that's in a rain shadow, and unless the mice or the rats or something get at it, it's pretty well preserved, you see that? And with modern technology, and they're very careful, they can get a lot of these fragments out here and we can read them. The only trouble is that it's a fragment, you see that? And you don't know where it comes from. See, if you have a document from modern historical times, well, you know when the Declaration of Independence that Thomas Jefferson wrote, we know its background and everything, you see that? It's well produced, we have no problem. But many of these things we just don't have. That's the problem of the Dead Sea Scrolls. We'll come to this a little later again. Now I'd like to get into New Testament times, specifically the time of Jesus. This is an aerial photo of the Mediterranean Sea at one point where there is an obstruction. And this was used by King Herod the Great to build up the Roman central capital to hold down those Jews and get the taxes. This was part of their empire way out there, and the Jews were always kind of wanting to get freedom and so forth. Well, we know from the New Testament, the tax collectors and all this. And this is Caesarea. He called it after the Emperor Caesar Augustus. And what you see here is only later parts of what originally had been there. This is a better photo. If you can see where that boat is going here, this is one harbor, and here's another harbor, an inner harbor. And this was the great capital city. I think for you, an archaeological picture doesn't help too much, but this might help you. The National, no, this is the Reader's Digest, Atlas of the Bible, reconstructs this. And this was Caesarea, a walled city here. Notice how they've done this. Herod and his engineers, they were really Roman engineers, built a large ramp here. There's a swift current here to stop this and make a harbor for the trading boats. But for your military boats and the real power, you had this tremendous outer harbor here that goes down 140 feet to protect that, because there's not a good harbor there. And this would be kind of the main objects. Now, since this is done, the National Geographic had a marvelous reproduction of this in one of its recent articles. They really do very well. And how they do a lot of scuba diving here, you see that? And they find out how they did this. And that's underwater. They were able to have cement that would harden in seawater way down below. And they could sink this down here and build way out there and sink it all the way down this harbor and build everything else. And of course, then after you got in the inner harbor, there you'd have the temple of Augustus Caesar. So here you have the outer harbor, and then you go into the inner harbor here. This is from a little different angle. What's going in here? And this would be the Ferris, the lighthouse for ships. And that's the capital city. Pontius Pilate lived here. When he went up to Jerusalem at the time of the Passover to keep those Jews straight, so it wouldn't be a revolution, then he stayed in the old palace up there. But his home was down here. And there's a lot of excavation that's still being going on here. Well, now this is Mount Carmel, where Elijah was, and there's a nice road here, and Megiddo is there, and this is a beautiful Israelon, and Galilee is there, so we're getting into New Testament time because Jesus came from Galilee. But these are beautiful valleys here, and this picture was taken in the wet season, and that's only in November, December, January, and February. Otherwise, it's pretty well dry. Most of the pictures you see of Palestine aren't that nice. But I happened to be there this January, and it's really very nice to see it at that time. What do you think that is?
Galilee.
The Sea of Galilee, yes. Mm-hmm. So Jesus' home was over here, Nazareth. The Via Maris, they called it in Latin, the Way of the Sea. You'd call it Interstate 5. It runs along here, going to Damascus, see? And this is where, up the way here, is where Capernaum was. That was Jesus' home. At his mission, his hometown was Nazareth. And maybe we ought to go back. First I'll show you this general thing. This is the crescent shape of the plain of Gennesaret. And this would be actually Capernaum, his home. And this would be Bethany. And then there would be up here Magdala, where Mary Magdalene came from, and then Tiberias. So somehow or other, after Jesus went to that revival meeting next to the Jordan River, he never went back to carpentering. In fact, when he went back to Nazareth, they threw him out. Remember that? And he never stayed with John the Baptist. And then he worked in Galilee in various parts. And the Mark's Gospel says this is his town, Capernaum. So we'll look a little at the archaeology. But before that, I have this picture by an artist for the National Geographic, Torino, who pictures Jesus. Can you find Jesus on this picture? His father is called Joseph A. The English translation is not quite accurate. Carpenter, that means a woodworker. But the Greek word is tekton. Tekton, tectonic place, is how you build up things. Construction worker. And since there was a larger city than Nazareth, 4 miles away, many of the modern scholars feel that maybe Joseph and Jesus worked on construction work 4 miles away at the place where Herod Antipas was building the city of Sepphoris. There's a lot of work there. I had never been on that site until very recently, and I had read about it, of course, and they found out that there's a lot of construction. Now, this could well have been. And if you have the Sea of Galilee here, there's another picture of the same area where he is kind of centered in his work. You have the fishermen. So maybe Peter looked like this more than when we see him like a bishop in the church. There's nothing wrong with the bishops. But I think it's isn't that the way the gospel stories are? They were fishermen, weren't they? Mm-hmm. I'll make you fishers of men. And so we have to kind of reconstruct our ideas there. And this is called the quest for historical Jesus. And it's a very important quest. Very important. Now, from the air, we have this site of Capernaum, the most important part. The site here has been kept for centuries by the Franciscan monks who live in that building in the back there. You can see it in the upper corner there. And they've done a lot of work. In fact, since this picture was taken, they have built over which might have well been Peter's home here. You can see that they've had a structure there, isn't it? And in the 5th century, there was a church there, octagonal church. And now the Franciscans, it's wonderful for pilgrims. They have built a kind of a plastic floor that you can see when you have mass upstairs, you can see downstairs to where it was, where the early Christians worshiped. And here's part of these houses that's just excavated like anybody excavates today. And here was the synagogue. When I was first there in 1954, I went with a guide, and he was really wrong. He said this was the synagogue in which Jesus preached, like we've had in the Gospels this summer, Jesus to Capernaum in John 6. Well, this is really 4th century, and below it, however, they've dug up all this. They had to put this stuff back together, but archaeologists know how to do that, to its foundation, and found the 1st century synagogue. So even though we don't have a lot of things about Jesus, we kind of know a little about how life was at that time. The entrance here to the synagogue, and the little steps along the side here, and then, of course, facing here, and they'd have the Torah, the little cabinet with all the scrolls in the sacred place there, kind of the sanctuary and the Holy of Holies for that. And I think you know this, that if Jesus came or anyone else and was asked to read, and you see he could read, they took out the scroll and then he read. Isn't that the story we had when Jesus came back to Nazareth? That he took out the scroll and he turned it to the prophet Isaiah, chapter 60, the Lord has anointed me to what? Preach the gospel, isn't it? To help the poor and all that. And this happens to be a rabbi. And one of these rabbis have a little box on their forehead. Anyone know?
Phylactery.
Pardon?
Phylactery.
Yes, it's a phylactery. Actually, what it is a quotation from Deuteronomy 6:4. Which says what? Yes. Yeah. It's the most sacred thing in Judaism. You go to synagogue service anytime, they'll say, Adonai Eloheinai, Adonai Echad, Shema Yisrael. And everybody, just like when we recite our creed, you see that? They recite, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one. This is monotheism, you see that? And you'll get hurt if you have any other gods, you see that. And you shall love him with all your heart, with all your mind, with all your soul. And then write this, that would be this message, and put it as frontlets between your eyes and on your arms. So you see they have little ribbons with another box there. And when you walk on your way, or when you go on the door, and so if this were a Jewish place, that doorway would have a little mezuzah there, which would have Deuteronomy 6:4, and pious Jews would go through there, they would bless it and kiss it as a sign of adoration to God's Torah, that they want to live it. So we have a pretty good idea of the New Testament. Now, New Testament archaeology. If you take that octagon, you saw it in the picture, didn't you? The octagon church from the 5th century. And all the walls, they have a baptistry there and an apse, and kind of reconstructed it. It must have looked like this, but I think I have a better three-dimensional reconstruction of that church. See, Constantine was the first emperor who was Christian in the 4th century and allowed Christians to be citizens and not be persecuted. And so in the 4th century already, Christianity began to grow. And by the 5th century, there are quite a few Christians here. But if we dig down below that, as we do in archaeology, if you go to the 4th century, you found that this one large room was, this is open to the sky, and the others are just courtyards here. The largest room in this place where they lived was perhaps St. Peter's house, mentioned in Mark 2, where Jesus healed Peter's mother-in-law. And here they have reinforced this, so the gathering of the Christians would be here. So the Jews are gathering in the synagogue over there, just like in a modern city, isn't it? And then you've got Christians gathering over here. And if you go down to the time of the first century, this would be that room where you enter. And here was a large room. And if you go back and put it in 3D, well, it's a little different angle, but here you can see that. And that's the largest of the rooms there that are open for such gatherings. So that gives you an idea of New Testament archaeology. And they try to do this at most places. And this will still go on. Well, I have to finish up now, although I think we have quite a bit of time today, which is good. By taking you to Jerusalem. Jerusalem, here you can see in the background, what do you have there? Can you see way back here? What do you think that is? The Dead Sea. And this is the wilderness of Judah. And this is Mount of Olives. And this is the temple area. And this is the modern city. It's very close. This is the Church of the Holy Sepulchre here. This happens to be the Lutheran church that was built by the Kaiser, who was a Lutheran for his Lutheran Christians, and he built for the Roman Catholics the Dormition of Mary, a beautiful church over here, which is there. And a beautiful hospital, which is still used by the Arabs way up here in Mount Scopus. That's perhaps the way it looked at Jesus' time. The Gentile, court of the Gentiles, court of the women, court of the men, and the priest only could get there, and the high priest inside here only once a year. And this would be the city. This is a very wealthy part of the city. Even have a theater. And this was the palace built by King Herod, later on used by the Roman procurator Pilate. And perhaps this is where the condemnation of Jesus was. They had a large fortress here to control for security case, all the things that happened there. And over here, the Garden of Gethsemane. And and this would be the place of the crucifixion outside. If we have time, I'll show you just a bit about that. This is a Jewish women's picture of the same thing from a different angle. Here you can see this large fortress. Can you see it with the large towers there? Four towers here? That does what? Controls the population. Here, Roman soldiers, get the idea? And they're controlling what? All the pilgrimage people who come up here. And so, for instance, during Holy Week, when Jesus argued with the people, this would be in this section. And that's the court of the Gentiles. The women can come this far, the men only this far, and then the priests inside. See the whole thing? It's rather interesting. From the Atlas, Reader's Digest Atlas, you can see those large towers there. And you can actually walk up these stairs here. You're certainly walking. That's been excavated where Jesus walked. Very, very interesting. All these tremendous amount of people that came from all nations. And they built, sometimes you can see them right at the wedding wall, you can see them, tremendous blocks building the walls. In fact, that's the famous Willy Wall. And those stones were there, built by Herod the Great. So they were there at the time of Jesus. This is a very interesting picture. It's taken only this January. Modern Israel has to protect and have security. And they've got good security. You see that? You can't possibly get in there. If you're a... well, you have to tell them where you want to go. If you're a Jew, or if you want to go in here to the temple, to the Wailing Wall, or the Western Wall, that's fine. If you want to go up here, and you want to get into the Muslim section, you go up here, and get into the Muslim section, the Dome of the Rock. I'll be a little more quick on the next slides, but this will give you an idea of what goes on there today. Here is a bar mitzvah for the young boys, who at the age of 12 will what? Be people of the law, and a great celebration. And here is an Oriental Jew next to the wall at the time of Tabernacles. Notice he has all the reeds and all the plants that come from the desert, and has all the prams, the prayers, many of them songs that we use, and updating that on that festival. Here's another picture, an aerial picture of the same region, going up here. This is the Mosque of Aqsa. Muhammad ascended on a winged donkey up to heaven from this place. So this is very important. And this is given to the Muslims today. And this is the place where the altar was. And that's why it's called the Dome of the Rock. We'll see that in just a minute.
That's also the site of the old temple?
Yes, of the temple courtyard with the altar outside. Not of the Holy of Holies, get the idea? In fact, I'll show you a picture in a minute. It's called the Dome of the Rock. It's beautiful. It was made when the Muslims took over this as a kind of a rival to the Christian Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And it was built, by the way, by Christian architects and men at that time. There wasn't a lot of rivalry. This is inside of it. Isn't that beautiful? That's inside the Dome of the Rock. All kinds of quotations from the Quran. And here you can see part of the top, but you can also see that rock. See, that's the rock you ask about here. That would be the rock. You can see there have been a lot of cuttings on it. There have been a lot of work. And you can even see where the blood went down into the sewer.
From the old Temple of Solomon.
Yes, Solomon's temple was built here too. You know? Mm-hmm. The first temple was built here, second temple. And there are some Jews who would like to come back and build a third temple. You see that? Take it over. But to get the Muslims out of that, that'd be a real problem. You see that? They have enough problems without that. Now, the last pictures I have to do with the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. For Christians, rather important. Many Christians will go to a garden tomb, which is north of the sites that you've seen. Most scholars, including myself, wouldn't say that this is authentic, but it is a beautiful garden, and if you'd like to kind of celebrate, I know some of my friends who are archaeologists say, on Easter, we like to go to the garden. The big church is too filled with people, and we'd rather celebrate it here. And it has a few old tombs here, very, very, but you'll find old tombs all over Jerusalem, an ancient place like this. This is the church that the Crusaders built. It's quite old. But it's been since Pope Paul VI made his pilgrimage here. He got all the Christians to cooperate, those that have rights to this old church, and they really have improved it very much. I had been there before, already in 1954, 40 years ago, and it wasn't as nice as it is now. When the Crusaders came there, the old church had a big dome over the spot of the tomb. And here's one of the Crusaders, bishops from France, together with the French Crusaders that are finally taking it over. And basically, that's what you have today. You have a big dome, and then this section would be where Calvary was. They're very close, because you remember, it wasn't far away. If you want and I have this a little wrong, but I think you can get the idea. This perhaps is the way it looked at the time of Constantine. This was the shrine over the tomb, and this was the shrine over Calvary. And this is where the Greek church is today. Well, I'll take you inside, and then you'll really see what it looks like. Through the Pope's visit, they were able to really do archaeology inside of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. So that the section, this is a kind of a map that they finally came out with, where Calvary, when you go up there, you have to climb quite high to get up there. And that's where, traditionally, and I think it's perhaps the place, the cross stood. And this is solid rock, even though it's now a shrine over it, where the tomb was. But that's, of course, the result of a lot of building over the centuries. If you go with the pilgrims on Friday on the way of the cross, they finally always end up in this church, and it was really wonderful. This is, it really belongs to the Greek Orthodox. Roman Catholics have a similar one next year where they can have Mass, but anybody can use this. This is free. And right here is this top of that mound. So, of course, it's as these places tend to be an altar. But for people...